Well, I don't know what your attitude is to New Year resolutions. It's easy to be cynical about New Year resolutions. Alle Jahre wieder. They come and they go. They seem to go quicker each year or last less long each year. It's easy to get rather discouraged by the idea of a New Year resolution. Is that Neujahrvorsatz in German? Anyone nod? Yeah? A Vorsatz? Yeah. And maybe you give up on the idea altogether, as I have done the last few years. It's not easy to keep it going when you get to my age. Although I have got a few this year, actually, but I'm not going to reveal what they are because it's always too embarrassing when people notice that they haven't lasted more than a week or so. In the morning service, we've just got to or are getting to the end of a series on the life of Jacob. I had hoped to finish it by Christmas, but we didn't quite manage to. So then I thought, well, I'll just leave it. Don't need to finish it. I mean, don't need to get to the very last chapter that's about Jacob. But after consideration, I realized that, ironically, the final passage of the series, which is today's passage, actually makes a rather good passage for the start of a new year and might even inspire some of us to New Year resolutions. So I'm preaching on this passage at both services today with some alterations. Some of you may have noticed some already if you were here this morning. And because we haven't had the whole series, I'll need to give a bit more background along the way to put the whole thing in a bit of context. But basically, we've been following Jacob on two parallel journeys. And one of those journeys, you might want to call it the return journey. He started in Canaan, promised land, Palestine, Israel today. And he's had to flee from there because he upset his brother by deceiving him. And he fled north and east to his uncle Laban. That's the journey out. And the journey back is the same journey, pretty much in reverse. That's the return journey, a geographical journey. And then there is a one-way journey. And that journey is in terms of his development as a person. Character formation, we might say. And in terms of his relationship with God. So we see, and we hope this is going to be a one-way journey, because it's not a journey he should be going backwards on, that it's a journey from being utterly self-centered and self-absorbed and actually dishonest to being someone who is becoming at least a bit more God-centered and other people-centered and honest. So both of those journeys have involved lots of fits and starts, we would say in English, ups and downs, points of acceleration and points of slowing down almost to a standstill. For example, he had quite a few ups and downs with working for his uncle Laban, who actually managed to get the better of him on one or two occasions. He worked 7 years for Rachel, and Laban made sure that the woman he married was actually her less attractive sister, Leah, not the desire of Jacob's heart. That was just one of the things that happened along the way. Maybe one way to chart those journeys is to look at a set of promises and commitments made as they set out, or as he set out, but they as in with God, away from Canaan. And perhaps just turn back to chapter 28. You may remember from the carol service, I mentioned the passage we're going to just briefly look at. On his journey, fleeing his brother's wrath, he lies down to sleep in open country, and he has a dream of the heavens being opened and angels going up and down on what may be a ladder or a staircase of some sort. And at the top of it, whether he sees God or just knows that God is speaking from there, he hears the voice of God speaking. And these are the promises that God makes to him on that occasion. 28 verse 13. The Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, in fact his grandfather, that's a Hebrew way of putting it, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give to you and to your offspring. your offspring. Offspring, slightly odd word, just means nachkomne, or descendants. Your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in you and your offspring shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I am with you, and will keep you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. And then we hear his response in verse 20. He made a vow saying, if God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God. And this stone which I've set up for a pillar shall be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will give a full tenth to you. Those commitments form, if you like, the parameters of what is going on in these journeys. They give us the editorial line. We're watching to see if both sides will keep those commitments. But no points for guessing who does and who doesn't keep those commitments. But roughly speaking, we don't see a lot of progress in Jacob when he first gets to Uncle Laban's. It's not until chapter 31, after all these setbacks with not the wife he intended, so he has to work another 7 years, 14 years in total before he can marry Rachel, then another 8 years or so with Laban trying to exploit him and him trying to exploit Uncle Laban. But all that time, he's pretty slow to draw any conclusions. He's still pretty much trying to make it in his own strength. And it's not until the Lord appears to him and tells him that it's time to head home that things begin to change in chapter 31. So I'll read you a few verses from chapter 31, 3 to 7. The Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your kindred, and I will be with you. So, yes, to 7. So Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah into the field where his flock was and said to them, I see that your father does not regard me with favor as he did before, but the God of my father has been with me. So it's the first time that we're hearing Jacob recognizing that. You know that I have served your father with all my strength, yet your father has cheated me and changed my wages 10 times. But God did not permit him to harm me. And verse 9, thus God has taken away the livestock of your father and given them to me. Slightly more to it than that. It's a slightly oversimplified, sanitized version of his slightly deceitful practices. But even so, God was in some way helping him along the way. So he's beginning to see things more clearly. He sets off on the journey home, but he knows that a great unknown awaits him at the other end. What will be the reaction of his brother Esau after these 20 years? Is he still fuming, or is he now willing to forgive and forget? And as it turns out, the meeting, when it finally happens, goes better than his wildest dreams. So 33 and verse 4, Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. But even before that, Jacob does seem to be a changed man. But all the time, he's a very ambivalent character. We're never quite sure how deep the change goes. It's easy enough to turn to God in a crisis. The real test sometimes is actually how we relate to God when things are going well. But there are a number of signs of a new Jacob emerging. I think that might be getting to... Oh! Could Nora just help him? I did a new version of it just before the service, which I think is on the desktop. And that was the one from this morning, sorry. Beg your pardon. Anyway, that may help you a bit when we get there. Anyway, signs of a new Jacob. He prays for the Lord's help in a way that we haven't come across before. That was back in verse chapter 32. Perfect. There we are. Signs of the new Jacob. We're halfway down. He prays. He's beginning to be a man of prayer. I won't read that to you. It's 32, 9 to 12 if you want to check it. He shows growing awareness that behind Esau's grace towards him is actually God's grace, God's undeserved love. He acknowledges that he stole the blessing from Esau, that that was offense against God too. And he's aware how little he deserves all the wealth that he has. So he's beginning to see that it's ultimately not as a result of his own effort. So in chapter 33, just a couple of verses to indicate that, verse 5, Jacob said halfway through, "The children whom God has graciously given your servant." And again in verse 11, "Please accept my blessing that is brought to you," he says to Esau, "because God has dealt graciously with me. I've experienced God's grace." He's beginning to acknowledge that and be aware of that. Signs of a new Jacob. But there are also shades of the old Jacob. That's particularly true in the second half of that chapter 33, where he reacts to to Esau's unexpected friendliness. So, listen to 33 verse 12. Esau said, "Let us journey on our way and I will go ahead of you." He's looking forward to having his brother back in the land, getting to know one another again and so on. But Jacob said to him, tell me if this sounds like an excuse or the truth. "My Lord knows that the children are frail and that the nursing flocks and herds are a care to me. If they are driven hard for one day, all the flocks will die. Let my Lord pass on ahead of his servant, and I will lead on slowly at the pace of the livestock that are ahead of me, and at the pace of the children, until I come to my Lord in Seir." But he never does come to my Lord in Seir. Once Esau's gone ahead, he heads off in a slightly different direction. Esau said, "Let me leave with you some of the people who are with me." But he said, "Oh, what need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of my Lord." So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir, but Jacob journeyed to Sukkot, built himself a house and made booths for his livestock. And that gave the name to that place. He stays there long enough to build a house. So the journey back home is broken off at that point. And then he moves on to Shechem, where he doesn't build a house. He at least remains in a tent, but he came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, on his way from Paddan Aram, and he camped before the city. And from the sons of Hamor, Shechem's father, he bought for 100 pieces of money the piece of land on which he had pitched his tent. And there he erected an altar and called it El Elohe Israel. Just for your interest, verse 18 could be translated slightly differently. It could be, "He came to Salim, the city of Shechem," as in the city of Shechem, the person. And it could be indicating to us that it was only after this, because of the son of Hamor, the boss of the city, Oberbürgermeister, if you like, because of the son being called Shechem, that it later became known as Shechem. Take your money, or he pays your money, or take your choice. Either is possible. But it makes it slightly confusing talking about the person Shechem and the city Shechem in the same sermon. But he builds his altar, and he even names it after the new name that God has given him, El Elohe Israel. There's a second name that God had given him a chapter or two before. He's making all the right noises there. But you wonder a little bit, is that just a smokescreen? Because if you think about it, his journey from Paddan Aram, the journey that God told him to take back to his father's land and so on, has come to a standstill. He's not yet back at his father's place. He doesn't get to Isaac until the very end of the chapter we were reading, chapter 35. And it seems he stays here in Shechem for a few years. You can roughly work that out from the age of Dinah or Dinah, his one daughter or the one daughter who's mentioned. Sometimes in ancient literature, the only daughters that get mentioned are the ones about whom something happens. The whole of chapter 34 is about her, and we would reckon that she was about 7 when they started out from Paddan Aram on the way back. She's now old enough for young men to fall in love with her. So that's quite a few years that he's sitting around in Shechem. And there are more shades of Jacob along the way. So in chapter 34, Dinah gets at the very least seduced, if not worse, by this chap Shechem, who does actually fall for her, and he tries to make an honest woman of her, and he tries to negotiate with Jacob for her hand in marriage. And Jacob is surprisingly inactive. He doesn't do much. It's really Dinah's brothers, her full brothers, also children of the unfavored wife Leah, who really fight for her. And they fight fairly dirty. They trick the men of the town into making themselves very vulnerable in a rather charming way, and then slaughtering them wholesale and seizing their property. You can read it for yourselves, or you can come back next Sunday morning, but we'll be looking at that passage. But it is an appalling scene, chapter 34. It's what we would today call a war crime or ethnic cleansing. And it leaves the whole of Jacob's household out of favor, to use a little understatement, with the inhabitants of the land. So getting close to chapter 35 at last. At the end of 34, Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You have brought trouble on me by making me stink to the inhabitants of the land. My numbers are few, and if they gather themselves against me and attack me, I shall be destroyed, both I and my household." But they said, "Should he treat our sister like a prostitute?" Three little things that may indicate the old Jacob having the upper hand at this point. He's passive, not active, even when the honor of his daughter is at stake. His concern is pragmatic rather than principled. "I shall be destroyed." Or maybe I should read that verse 30, second half, slightly differently. "My numbers are few, and if they gather themselves against me and attack me, I shall be destroyed. Oh, both I and my household." Slight sense in which the others are a slight footnote to his real concerns, which are for himself. And of course, he's not in the place he should be. Shechem is a diversion from the journey that he's supposed to be on. So shades of the old Jacob having the upper hand at that point, but we move on into chapter 35. And the new Jacob begins to show itself again. God gives him a nudge towards resuming his journey. He prompts him, "Arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there. Make an altar there," and so on. And he obeys forthwith, straight away. Possibly fear is part of the motivation. He needs to get away from Shechem because of what's happened there. But a clearer sign of the new Jacob is that he realizes what action is needed, not just to follow God's command, but he does something that God hasn't specifically instructed. He knows that it's not a light thing to draw near to God, that they need to prepare themselves and not do that casually. So he issues the command, "Put away the foreign gods that are among you and purify yourselves and change your garments." Which, of course, raises another question. It's a little bit like you might call it the Shechem question. Why are you in Shechem, Jacob? Well, here's another similar question. Why have you got all those household gods in the first place, Jacob? Now, okay, the Mosaic law hasn't been given. We're still at Genesis, not yet Exodus. But it seems very clear they know that Yahweh is the one true God, and he only should be worshipped. But at least he knows that they need to go, that it's not safe to set on a journey with the Lord without getting rid of them. And then the purifying themselves, this may well relate to what has happened in the previous chapter, the blood guilt that is on them, the contact with dead bodies and so on, and that may also explain why they need to change their garments. So even though the law of Moses hadn't been given, there is some sense of what is appropriate before God. And they follow his command. They gave Jacob all the foreign gods that they had and the rings that were in their ears. Not that if anything wrong with having earrings, of course, just it seems to be the particular earrings needed to be got rid of. Jacob hid them under the terebinth tree that was near Shechem. You could also translate that, he buried them. Slight difference, isn't there? You see, you hide something to put it in safekeeping because you might come back for it later. And bury implies a more decisive break, doesn't it? That you're getting rid of these things for good. Again, ambiguity all the way through with Jacob. Is he really leaving the past behind? We can't be certain one way or the other, but there is at least some evidence of progress. He realizes what action is needed. Then he recognizes God's role. I'll say more about that in a minute, but here's his take on what has happened. Let us arise, at verse 3, and go up to Bethel, so that I may make there an altar to the God who answers me in the day of my distress and has been with me wherever I have gone. Well, that's sounding a little bit more definitively like the new Jacob. He had left the land as a young man who thought he could carve out his own future, and he's returned as an older, wiser man who realizes he's not a self-made man. He's a God-made man. Throughout the journey out and the journey back, the really decisive factor has not been his own abilities, his native wit, but God looking after him. He recognizes that. And he records his gratitude with that ceremony in 13 and 14, setting up a pillar so that it'll be evident publicly and also to posterity, to his descendants, a reminder to them all of the God who has been with him all this way. He sees that all that is evidence of God's gracious dealings with him. He is trying to do the right thing, even if he can't help the old Jacob showing through from time to time. And those are all good things for us to have in mind as we enter a new year. We too will often wander from the journey we're supposed to be on. We get plenty of things wrong along the way, but what matters is that we see it and do something about it as he did, that we realize what action is needed to get us back on track. Perhaps a new year is a time to reflect on that, to discern, where have I got off track with the Lord and need to take action to get back? And how clearly do we recognize the Lord's role in bringing us through the last year or whatever we may have been through recently? Do we see his hand in the good and the bad, in the tough things and the pleasant things? It may not have been an easy year for you, but has it been one of character formation like it was for Jacob? If so, it's something to give thanks for, even if it has left us limping in one way or another, as it did Jacob after one of his encounters with God. Do we recognize that God has used even the tough times to grow us, that he's protected us from worse things that might have happened to us, and that all along he is on a journey of making us who he wants us to be? And maybe there are ways we could and should record our gratitude publicly, privately, in prayer, in writing it down, talking to others, and so on. So getting back to Jacob, he does seem to be making progress on both his journeys, on that return journey and on the one-way journey with God. But there is that other side to the equation, that actually neither of these journeys would have got anywhere without the Lord's contribution. So here are three things we see him doing, the Lord doing, to keep Jacob in track, on track. First of all, he prompts him. I think that would be auffordern, something like that. A sort of gentle urging. Even though verse 1 shouldn't have been necessary, it is there. Arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there. Shechem has been a diversion. And sadly, he seems to have been really rather enjoying life in Shechem. And it takes quite a bit of pressure from the Lord to dislodge him from his comfortable life. Actually, it takes chapter 34, a very unpleasant, one of those horrible chapters in the scriptures. It takes a war crime, if you like, to push him on back into the journey that he should have been on all the time. So although the words of verse 1 may sound like a gentle nudge, a Rippenstoß, to get going again, if you take them in the light of the previous chapter, it's a bit more like a hefty shove, a schubs, in the right direction. It's always better to respond when God gives us a gentle nudge than to wait until he has to push us with a hefty shove. So again, is there anything God is nudging you to do at the moment, anything he's nudging you to change, any action he's nudging you to take to get you back on the journey that you keep putting off? So the longer we put it off, the harder it will be for the Lord to dislodge us, and the more painful it will be for us, and perhaps for others as well. So he prompts him, and he protects him. Ah, is page 2 not available? Apologies. It may have been my incompetence. He protects him, secondly. They're very simple points, actually, so you probably will survive without the distraction of the diversion of the overhead, or whatever that thing's called. We heard that by the end of chapter 34, Jacob and his household are a stench in the nostrils of the people of the land. And that's a dangerous position for a small tribe, but a wealthy tribe. So they're not so insignificant that they can be ignored. Greedy tribes around them will want to attack them. And when they set out on the journey again and they're vulnerable en route, that will be the time when those other tribes might try to take advantage of them. But what does the Lord do? Verse 5 of our chapter. As they journeyed, a terror from God fell upon the cities that were around them, so that they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. When you read chapter 34, you'll realize how unbelievably undeserved that protection is. But of course, it's not just a protection of them personally, but a protection of the promises that are wrapped up in Jacob and his sons. We too are dependent on the Lord's protection. It may well not be our experience that a terror from God falls upon the people around us, but the view from the bridge, if you like, of the church family is that our enemy took plenty of opportunities to have a go at us in the last year. We may have been in more of a battle than we realize, and that means we may have been protected much more than we realize. So let's make sure as we head into the new year that we pray for his protection on our journey and don't take it for granted. And thirdly, he promises him. Verses 11 to 12 are really the old promises, but with a few little bits added. God said to him, I am God Almighty, be fruitful and multiply, a nation and a company of nations shall come from you. And the new bit is, kings shall come from your own body. The land that I gave to Abraham and Isaac I will give to you, and I will give the land to your offspring after you. When the promise was first given to Abraham, it was pretty extraordinary. It was given a promise to a man who was elderly, with an elderly wife, and no children. But now it's the third generation, and there are 12 sons, so things are accelerating to a considerable extent, and signs of these promises beginning to be fulfilled. But the journey towards the full enjoyment of these promises isn't going to go in a straight line any more than Jacob's journey back has been going in a straight line. The Lord makes promises, but he doesn't promise that the journey to fulfillment will be an easy journey or a straightforward journey. So that's God's side, and actually really it's what keeps him going on the journey. And the thing, as I said this morning, that strikes me most is something that you really only see clearly once you've preached your way through the previous chapters about Jacob and see his life as a whole and where he's got to at this point. And that is the sheer relentlessness of God's grace. Relentless is unnachgiebig. I think I've put it on this time. Oh, it's gone. Unnachgiebig. Someone didn't hear me say it, so I'll say it again. Relentlessness is unnachgiebigkeit. You need to remember that because I'm going to use that word several times now. If you or I had been in God's place looking after, watching over Jacob, you or I would, I think, have given up on Jacob long ago. He's very stubborn, very self-centered, very slow to learn in all sorts of ways. But the Lord keeps faith with him. He keeps chipping and chiseling away at him. Perhaps rather like he does and has to do to you and me. He keeps shaping him and reshaping him. He ensures that he remains a carrier of the promises. Now that doesn't mean that God's relentless grace means it's so absolutely guaranteed that everything's going to work out that it doesn't matter what Jacob does, and that it sort of gives him a free pass to do what he likes, because the Lord will bail him out and smooth things over. On the contrary, we see again and again his wrongdoing has lasting consequences. For example, a divided family. The different wives and the children of the different wives fighting amongst themselves. We see sons who are disrespectful and usurp his authority. We've seen that, as I hinted in chapter 34, Simeon and Levi take revenge in a way that Jacob wasn't happy with. And look on to verse 22 of our chapter. While Israel, Jacob's new name, lived in that land, Reuben, his oldest son, went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, his Nebenfrau. And Israel heard of it. And that comes up again right at the end of the book when he doesn't bless Reuben in the way Reuben expects because of that incident. But do you see how the behavior of Jacob has knock-on effects on others? God doesn't mop up everything and make everything sorted out again. Our detours and diversions do carry a price tag. But nevertheless, God's grace has no price tag on it. It is free and it is relentless. So that has been a great encouragement to me as I've been working through Jacob in the last few months. Remember, I said at the beginning, his journey lasts a good 20 years. And during this year, I'll be celebrating 20 years in Leipzig. And sometimes I do look back and think, quite a lot of Jacob along the way, but quite a lot of relentless grace along the way as well. English understatement. And we'll be celebrating 20 years of LEC, But maybe we shouldn't celebrate 20 years of LEC, but we should be celebrating in the autumn 20 years of relentless grace received again and again in different ways by different people. Through all the mistakes that have been made, through all the things that we may individually regret and may corporately regret, through all the detours and diversions that have taken us off the straight line that God might have taken us on. Through all the, well, there'd be no shortage of casualties and shipwrecks and collateral damage along the way. One of the things I find the most painful. But through it all, in spite of all our shortcomings, again and again, God picking us up and dusting us down and putting us back on track. His relentless grace. I don't think it would be worth my while getting up on Monday mornings if it wasn't for conviction about his relentless grace. May that be our experience in the coming year, leaving the shades of the past behind, living with signs of the new person that God is making in each of us, trusting him to show us more and more of his relentless grace. So maybe one New Year resolution for all of us could be that when he speaks, we should follow. That we should be people who respond to God's gentle nudging and don't wait until he has to give us a hefty shove in the right direction.